Are you among the many who have resolved to get their financial affairs in order this year? Many boil it down to two pretty basic concepts: save money, stop spending it. Or maybe, as someone we know says, spend less, have more. Why is it so hard? Kevin McKinley is back with us this week on another edition of On Your Money, and he'll have tips for getting the year started off right, financially speaking. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have any personal finance questions, you can call them in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Cynthia? Is that right?
That's right.
What have you done with Joy, Cynthia?
She is at an undisclosed location.
Well, I hope she's someplace that is 45 degrees warmer than it is here in Wisconsin right now, which would be Anchorage, Alaska.
I've been tracking Antarctica's temperatures for fun as well.
And it's just about to feel worse.
Yeah, it's 35 degrees there. So,
but I'm not going to vacation in Antarctica, but I wish her well wherever she is, and thank you for filling in for her.
Sure. Well, we begin our first show of 2014 with some thoughts on how you can make your new year as happy as possible. What's on your mind, Kevin?
Well, a lot of us are trying to make New Year's resolutions, and many times those resolutions can be most effective if we quantify them. Say that we want to save $500 more per month, or we want to lose 5 pounds a month or something like that. But sometimes it's just more useful to adopt philosophies. And especially if you can combine them with actions and themes that can work with your finances to give you the most happiness from your money and your life that you possibly can get. And so over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about a few of these themes, but we'll preview some of them today.
And what's the first one?
The first one is time, and especially spending your time versus spending your money. And we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but this is activities like cleaning or remodeling or shoveling or yard work or even sometimes caring for your child. These are things that we have to do, and many of us feel morally obligated to do it, even though someone might be able to do it better than us, and we might be able to pay that person. And if that person is agreeing to perform that task for a certain price and we pay that person to do that task, we're actually doing that person a favor, and we may reduce our amount of stress. We may be safer if these are activities that we're not particularly skilled at that might be dangerous. And best of all, it allows us to spend our time more wisely and more enjoyably for us in doing things that give us more happiness.
Like what?
Experiences. There are several studies out, and we're going to be going in depth in the next couple of weeks about how many times people get more enjoyment out of experiences than they do by buying stuff, by spending their money on doing things rather than buying stuff. Several studies have shown that the anticipation of buying something gives people a much bigger rush than actually owning and using the item afterwards. Whereas if they spend their money on an experience, especially if it's an experience that's done with people they like, it's enjoyable to plan it. It's enjoyable while they're doing it, usually. But afterwards, the glow is much, much greater than it is for an item that they've purchased.
What's the last theme then for a better year?
Gratitude. And people who are successful in terms of achieving things, whether it's, you know, as much as getting their car started this morning or paying off their mortgage or whatever your goal might be, we tend to focus on what's above us and what's ahead of us and what's undone. And that generally leads to more success, but it doesn't lead to more happiness because you are always looking at something that's undone or somewhere in which you're lacking. And so sometimes it's a good idea to turn around and focus on what you have rather than what you don't have, and especially relative to others. So we're going to talk about how to figure out where you fit in the world in terms of what you make or what you have, your possessions, your time, your energy, your health, whatever, and to adopt a position of gratitude so that you can get more happiness over where you are rather than sadness over where you wish you were.
Well, it's certainly something to think about and probably easier said than done, so we look forward to your advice there. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. Kevin, a listener named Patty says, how do we find a financial planner who has the same philosophy as yours? How do we go about finding a financial planner who doesn't want to sell us products? We need to discuss how to go forward with the plan for my husband's retirement and whether that's feasible given our circumstances and the amount we've saved. Thank you in advance for your time, and I hope to hear from you. If not, I turn off the radio and say, off with you. Sincerely, a devoted but fickle fan. Wow. So what advice do you have for her, Kevin?
Well, I'm glad we took this question, because if she and her husband both stop listening to the show, that's half of our audience
there.
And so we can't afford that kind of drop right now. Well, I can't help her find a financial planner exactly like me, for better or for worse. I'm not bragging here, but I'm fairly unique. But there are lots of good people out there who practice in the same manner, in that they typically charge people on an hourly basis or as a percentage of their assets rather than an actual commission basis. And thankfully, that philosophy of compensation is becoming more common in the financial advisory business. The biggest issue, of course, is trust. And it's establishing trust not only with the advisor establishing trust with the clients, but also with the advisor trusting the clients too, so that you're both on the same page and that you have the same goals and you have the same expectations. So the big issue is how they're paid, but there are also other questions that people will have for financial advisors that we'll be discussing in the near future.
Okay, well, where should an investor start?
There are three main websites that list fee-based financial planners. One is NAPFA, NAPFA.org. The other is FPANet.org. And finally, the Certified Financial Planning Board has one called Let'sMakeAPlan.org. Those all allow you to find listings of financial planners. Usually you will find ones that are fee-only, and they will disclose on there if they are fee and commission or if they bill by an hour as well. There's also a smaller network called the Garrett Planning Network, where a woman named Cheryl Garrett has trained several financial planners and put them in her network as well. And those are generally going to be fee-based or hourly-based planners as well. Some of the problems, though, that you might find by looking those, by the way, we'll put websites and links to those up at onyourmoney.com later on today. But when you're looking for that, a lot of times, especially those of us in northern Wisconsin, there aren't many people who run into financial planners in their local area. And so they may have to make other choices if they can't find a person on these websites who is in their immediate area.
So what other options are there then?
Well, first of all, several different companies provide nationwide services over the phone or online. Some of them have local offices, but generally they prefer to do things on the web and on the telephone. Big companies like Vanguard, Fidelity, TIA Cref, even WA here in Wisconsin provides some financial planning services to their members. USAA, which was a financial services company primarily designed for members of the military and retired members, they're now opening up their services to other members of the general public. And finally, there's a newer company called LearnVest, which purports to hook you up with a financial planner for a few hundred dollars to start, and then a monthly retainer fee that typically runs for about $20 to $40 or so, depending on the service, type of assets that you have, and what you want from that person.
Any other issues to consider here?
Yeah, we mentioned the biggest question, which is how the people are paid and what they do for what they're paid. And the biggest issue in terms of the financial industry is who is a fiduciary. And by legal definition, a fiduciary has to put the client's interest first before and ahead of their own interest. And so that might mean telling them to do things that might cut the income or the earnings of the advisor, but the advisor thinks it's the best thing for them. fiduciary doesn't guarantee happiness for the client, meaning that some people aren't fiduciaries, yet they're very good financial advisors. Some people are fiduciaries and deliver an unsatisfactory experience. But we're going to talk about how to find a fiduciary, what you should ask for, and other questions once you do to put in place once you do actually find your own potential financial advisor.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and we're taking your calls this week on your money at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin, let's talk to Stan in Milwaukee. Hi, Stan.
Good morning, Kevin. I have a question about plan on buying a home in northern Wisconsin. I have a home here in Milwaukee. I'm 75 years old. I've been investing for 45 years, and I've done well. My question is, I can pay cash for the home in northern Wisconsin. Would I be better off to finance it or to pay the cash and save the finance charges?
Can you pay, first of all, congratulations for having this choice in the first place, Stan. Can you pay for the home with cash that is not in a retirement account, or would you have to liquidate like an IRA or a Roth IRA?
I have the money in a, it's Edward Jones. It's invested with them, and I also, there's also a couple, two IRAs, one that was my wife who was deceased and mine. And a Roth IRA, and I don't believe that I would need to cash them in.
Okay, that's a good sign. And would you say, Stan, that were you to pay cash for the home, would it be more than 25% of your liquid net worth?
I haven't figured that out.
Well, go ahead and do it. We'll wait.
I would say it would be. Well, the home is selling for.
Let's rather than get the actual number, Stan, let's just look at this, and if it is going to be more than 25% of your liquid net assets, then I would be more likely to tell you to actually borrow the money for it. But I'm assuming that you don't itemize on your taxes anymore. Is that correct?
No.
Okay.
No.
It's not correct, or you don't itemize anything?
I don't itemize.
Okay. Then you don't get much advantage from deducting the interest on it. It can serve as a nice hedge. Getting a mortgage can serve as a nice hedge against rising interest rates. But if you don't deduct for it, and at a time when asset prices are probably closer to the highs rather than the lows, it might be a good time to pull some of that off of the table and just pay cash for it. I will say this. One nice thing about actually going out and getting the mortgage, it's a hassle, and there are expenses to do it. Typically, probably 2% or so of the cost of the actual purchase price is built up into the fees and the mortgage, et cetera. You can always pay that off if you want. You can pay it off the next day after you get the mortgage if you have the cash. But if for whatever reason in your life, Stan, it turns out that it would have been better off to go back and get the mortgage on January 7th of 2014, you can't necessarily do that, especially at the terms that are offered today. So if you think interest rates are going to go up from here, it might be a better hedge to actually get the mortgage now. And then if that doesn't happen, you get tired of the payment, then go ahead and just pay it off. But otherwise, if you have the cash, it's not in a retirement account, and you say, yeah, I don't want to monkey around with those extra fees, it might be a good thing to do to just write a check for the place.
Pay it off any time then if you financed it.
Yes, sir. You can check with the lender on this, but I've never seen a standard mortgage with a prepayment penalty on it. That might happen.
I just looked it up. The home is selling for $249,000.
Okay.
And I have $1.3 million.
Okay, then you would slide under that 25% benchmark of doing it. So in that case, I'd say that if you can have a paid-for home and still have $1 million in liquid assets, that's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah, the guy that is advising me is in the Edward Jones there said that I should be able to do it pretty good that way.
Mm-hmm.
but I wanted your advice.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Stan, for that call. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and this is On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email your personal finance questions to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
Help! I need somebody. Help! Not just anybody. Help! You know I need someone.
You're listening to On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're with Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC and a certified financial planner. You want to stick around. Coming up later in the hour, Kevin's going to have some financial moves to consider doing while the year is still young. Until then, we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Kevin, let's talk now to Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. I have sort of an embarrassing situation, I guess. And I know Kevin is so tender-hearted, he'll be kind to me.
Thank you, Barb.
A few years back, in fact, many years back, my husband and I had a small business, and we put some money in a SEP IRA. It was doing really, really well when we put it in, and a mutual fund, and then it crashed immediately. And I was going to take it out, but my brother said, no, what you do is you just invest the money, you put the statements in the drawer, you don't look at them, and you don't look at them every month and worry about it, so just leave it. So here I am many, many years later, and I now decided, you know, I ought to look at this. And the money is actually less than it was when I put it in all those years ago. I'm wondering, how do I get it out of there? How do I transfer it? It's not a local account. It's something I mailed off to. So how do I move it?
Well, that's a good question. Let's back up for a second. How many years are we talking in this situation, Barb?
Oh, about 20.
20 years. Okay. I would check that and see what the actual investment is. It's not shocking to me, and it's not embarrassing either. I mean, you actually followed your advice you were given to not look at it, but sometimes that can mean the ignorance is not necessarily blissful. Here's the problem with the situation. It's a question of, you know, first of all, you'd have to ask why did it not allegedly not make any money over those two decades of time when generally asset prices have gone up over the last 20 years, especially as of today. And the second one is what do you do with the money once it's out? Are you taking it out of something that may be more poised to rise and putting it into something that's gone up over the last 20 years, but they may therefore be more poised to fall? Do you have an idea as to what you would do with the money once you pulled it out?
I just thought that I would transfer it to a different fund.
Okay. Just be cautious of that, because sometimes individual investors and even advisors are guilty of taking money out of something that's gone down in value and putting it into something that has gone up in value, only then to experience what John Bogle, the legendary mutual fund guru at Vanguard, called regression to the mean, meaning that what goes up must come down. And so be cautious of doing that. And maybe try to get some kind of analysis of the fund so that you can see if it actually is, you know, if it's just a bad mutual fund, or is there some reason that it seemed to have underperformed over these two decades. Now, that said, once you find another fund that you would prefer, you can actually, depending on how the fund is held, you can either buy that fund within the SEP IRA or IRA, or you can actually open up a new IRA at the new fund sponsor or the other investment company or financial services company, and you can transfer the assets in kind. And if you transfer them in kind, and that's something that's initiated at the new company, the money generally will go over to that new institution without you touching it. And that means that you don't have to pay any taxes on it when it goes over until you actually pull the money out from the new institution and spend it.
So I go to the new people and ask them to get the money from the old people?
Yes, ma'am. That's correct. It sounds kind of strange, but that's the best way to do it. They'll have all the forms. They'll be more than happy to talk to you, I'm guessing. And they'll actually orchestrate and monitor the entire transfer process. They, you know, they can't sign your name for you, obviously, but most good firms, that's about all that they make you do.
Thanks for that call, Barb. You can call in your questions about personal finance and investing at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll go next to Woodbury, Minnesota with Terry on the line. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Cynthia and Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have kind of an embarrassing question also.
don't worry, it's just us here, Terry.
Okay, just us three. Okay, about a little over a year and a half ago, my husband and I consulted with a financial planner because we weren't happy with the one we were using, and based on your kind of recommendation, we went with a fee-only planner. He suggested we move all our money into Vanguard and gave us some account allocations. And to make the whole transfer process easier, I initially just moved all the money into the money market account with the plan to then distribute it later. Well, a year and a half later, the money is still sitting in the money market. I guess it seemed like there was also always some reason to hold off on doing it with everything going on with Congress, the debt ceiling and the fiscal cliff and all of that stuff. So anyway, a year and a half later, the money is still sitting in the money market, and I'm wondering now if I should do that fund allocation or are we nearing the top of the market and I'm going to be buying high and
hopefully not selling low at some point, right?
Right.
It's actually, you know, you're embarrassed about that. That's actually a very common dilemma that many investors have right now, because while it seems like, okay, everybody jumped back in at some point in the last 4 or 5 years, I'm guessing here the majority of investors either were shocked by the huge drops of 2008 and 2009 and never felt like they could handle that kind of drop again, or their own personal circumstances dictated that they either couldn't handle the drop or didn't need any big potential gains. There's a difference between wanting big gains and needing the gains. And also, a lot of people are very suspicious about a situation where much of the rise and fall of asset prices over the last few years has been tied somewhat into the actions of the Federal Reserve. And rather than judging companies just by their earnings or their dividends or their future prospects or bonds on their ability to pay their interest payments, we're kind of at the whim of the Federal Reserve, and that makes a lot of people very anxious about it. I'd say the same thing today that I would have said to you 4 or 5 years ago, Terry. Can you handle, you know, let's say it's $100,000. Can you handle a 30 or 40% drop in that value over, say, a given year? I take it the answer is no. that's something, whether you're investing in 1990 or 2000 or 2014, if you're going to be in the stock market especially, you have to be able to answer yes to that question at any given time, because we never know where the bottoms and the tops are. We can tell if we're closer to the bottoms or closer to the tops on a historical basis. But you have to be able to say yes to that, both from a financial standpoint, meaning a 30-40% drop isn't going to significantly affect your lifestyle, but also in terms of an emotional thing, which is way more severe sometimes than just numbers on paper, especially because all the news that you're seeing and hearing at that time is bad, and we're linear people. We tend to see things going in the same direction that it's been going, and so you can see a big drop leading down to zero, even though that's highly unlikely to happen. So if you need the money for immediate expenses, and you're going to be spending it, and it's going to drive you crazy if it drops 30-40%. I would say now is not the good time to put all your chips into the middle of the table. Maybe nibbling a little bit with a smaller portion of the allocation and trying to get the balance up a little bit. But understand that anytime someone puts money into, especially the stock market or mutual funds, you have to look at that figure and then cut off 30 or 40% of it and understand that that's the potential downside risk over, say, a given year at just about any given time.
I'm Cynthia Schuster with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money. If you have any questions about personal finance, get them in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. it's time for our Smart Assets segment. Kevin, January 1st brings many new opportunities for listeners to improve their finances. We're going to cover a few that should be considered right now. But where do we begin?
In terms of specific actions, one of them is the most basic. Please, people, if you are not doing this right now, now is as good a time as any to start, and that is tracking your monthly expenditures. It's one of the I've done this for 25 years. I've studied this inside and out. I live, breathe, eat, and sleep personal finance. Mm-hmm. And one of the key indicators of people who are what I would consider to be successful in their personal financial situation is that they track their expenses on a monthly basis, annually, and even compare year over year and month over month. And the great thing about that is, first of all, as we've talked about in the past, that figure is what predicates your financial security, so you can kind of know how you're doing. And the second thing is once you actually know where those expenses are, you can figure out what you might be able to cut.
What should be done with any extra money?
I'd like to see it prioritized in this manner, especially for working people. Build an emergency savings account. Get 6 to 12 months of expenses set aside. So if you're spending, say, $4,000 per month, which is about average for an American household, you should have $24,000 to $48,000 or so set aside in a liquid account. It's not going to make you any money, but more importantly, it's not going to lose you any money. This might be a checking account, it might be short-term CDs, or it might be another investment that we're going to talk about in a little bit. After you've established that 6 to 12 months of living expenses, then you should try to pay off any high-interest credit card debt. This is generally, by high, I mean interest rates in the double digits, like over 10%. And after you've done that, then you can start saving for retirement if you're working. Pre-tax plans are usually best, but if you don't have a plan at work, or you don't feel like you can afford to put that money aside, then use a Roth IRA. You don't get any tax break on the Roth IRA contributions, but you can pull those contributions back out at any time with no taxes or penalties. So it does allow you some immediate access to those funds. And generally what you'll find is you actually don't need them over the long term, and you will save some money for retirement. And speaking of which, you can make a contribution for a 2014 Roth IRA and IRA right now if you'd like. And then you have, in a strange twist of fate, you have another 3.5 months now to contemplate making a contribution to a 2013 IRA, Roth IRA as well.
Speaking of tax time, is there anything that needs to be done sooner rather than later?
A couple smaller things. First of all, if you did sell any securities or investments in 2013 that were outside of retirement accounts or annuities, meaning they weren't sheltered from taxes, you should start working right now on figuring out the cost basis of those securities, because the IRS is getting very particular about investors and companies providing actual cost basis numbers rather than throwing some estimate out there. Also, if you are itemizing, start putting together your information today that will verify all those deductions so that you not only know the number, but you have it in front of you in case you get audited down the road. And then start putting together the information in general. If you do have a CPA, the CPA generally will send a worksheet to you to start filling out those numbers. Or if you do it yourself, it's as good a time any to go to a place like TurboTax, see what their new version is. Because of the federal budget shutdown, even though it was a few months ago, there are going to be some delays in some of the reporting and the figures, because there was a big question about a lot of the laws and how it would affect our taxes for 2013. So there are going to be things, some roadblocks you're going to run into, but it's better to get done what you can get done right now so that when the delays come, you don't have anything else holding you back.
Right. Any other New Year's money moves we should consider making this year?
This is a common question we get of what to do with this cash I have just sitting in the money market. Should I put it in the stock market? I can't find any low-risk places or ways to earn a little bit more money. Series I savings bonds are one of our favorite places to put money that you may need, but that you'd like to keep safe and fairly liquid and earn a little bit of interest. The reason we say to do it right after the first of the year is you can only buy $10,000 of these bonds per person per calendar year. So again, for instance, a couple can buy $20,000 total. A single person can buy $10,000, but they're the Series I savings bonds. They pay about 1.18% right now. The interest rate is adjusted every May and November. The interest is exempt from state taxes. And best of all, you can defer paying taxes on the interest if you don't cash in the bonds. There's only a, it's tough to get the money out after the, or within the first 12 months of when you put it in there. After 12 months sold, there's only a 3-month interest penalty for pulling the money out. And after 5 years, there's no penalty at all. And the bad news about these is you do have to buy them yourself, and you do have to buy them online at the Treasury's website. And it's a pretty difficult process to get started. But once you get started, you have an online account that you can use to purchase the bonds, and go to treasurydirect.gov to purchase those Series I savings bonds.
This is On Your Money. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're with Kevin McKinley, a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can call in your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us onyourmoney@WPR.org. We did get an email from a listener, Kevin. He says, I have a farm that I would like to protect and pass on to my children. Should I consider a living trust or irrevocable trust? Is there some other type of trust I might want to consider?
I sound like a lawyer, but I'm actually not a lawyer. That said, in my experience, I would like, first of all, had to contact a lawyer. And second of all, I would think that's a good idea if there is an issue of how the farm will be owned. And a trust is kind of a vehicle that dictates the ownership structure of it and also the management structure of a particular asset, in this case, the farm. The irrevocable trust can be helpful if there is an estate tax issue, because once it's put into an irrevocable trust, it gets out of the current owner's estate, but it also is not really owned by the current owner. It's irrevocable and it goes into the trust. And there are provisions that can be that allow the donor to the trust, if you will, to get income from the farm, say, but once it's in that trust, it can't be attached again by or used by the owner for most purposes of ownership. But the living trust is a little easier to get in and out of. It's much less expensive. It's much more manageable on a year-to-year basis. And that's something that I would recommend as a first step. But please contact a lawyer, and not, you know, your neighbor who happens to have a law degree, but a person who is familiar with this particular type of transaction and has done a lot of them in the past. And quite frankly, and the more complicated the situation is, the more expensive it is, you can probably expect to spend at least a few $1,000s to get this set up. And there might be some ongoing expenses as well in terms of accounting for the trust, depending on how you set it up too. But in the right situation, it's money well spent.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine, and we're talking with Kevin McKinley, a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Stay tuned. It's time to shop around coming up after this.
My mama told me you better shop around.
A recent security breach at a major retailer had shoppers scrambling to see if they were at risk. What's the latest on the story, Kevin? Oh, Kevin, let me, there you go. Now tell us.
those who are at risk may still not even know if they've been compromised. This was the Target store hack where for people who use credit cards between November 27th and December 15th of last year, thieves hacked in and obtained the PIN numbers, the card numbers, the names, even that 3-digit code on the back of the card. They got all this of up to 40 million users during that time. And so Target has taken a lot of steps to assure people that they've hopefully patched the leaks and the holes. And they've also allowed them discounts. And they've said they'd give them free credit monitoring if they feel like they've been at risk. But in light of that, there really is not, you can't make every transaction 100% immune to fraud. And so there are several things that people should be doing right now to prevent this the next time it happens. And if you use plastic, it will happen. One of the biggest issues that people have to think about is whether they choose to use debit or credit.
Mm. What's the difference?
Well, credit cards may actually be a little safer, because the user of the credit card, meaning you, your credit card account, may be less likely to be liable for any fraud or purchases made with a card. Federal law says that at the most an owner of a card can be liable for fraudulent purchases, meaning purchases they didn't actually make, is $50. But most credit card users, or most credit card sponsors rather, say that, you know what, for $50 we might as well make it zero. And they do, meaning that you can check the terms of your agreement, but technically you are not liable for any charges on the card once you could prove that you didn't actually make them.
What about debit cards?
That you may actually have a bigger potential loss on the debit card. They can, in theory, drain the account if you don't catch it quickly enough. And there's the law, which is a very old law, but there's a certain time limit that you have to notify people for. If you notify the provider that your debit card has been compromised within the first 2 days of the loss or of the charges coming in, you're only liable for up to $50. But after that, you can be liable for up to $500, and even in technically the entire balance of the account. Because if you just say, well, someone took my debit card, charged a bunch of money on it, and several months ago, it's going to take a long time for the issuer to figure out that that person wasn't you. They're trying to prove a negative, and in the meantime, they may tie up your funds, and then that's only assuming you'll get it back if they resolve it successfully in your favor.
So which is safer to use, debit cards or credit cards?
Credit cards are actually the best to use if you have some issues with trusting the merchant or the process, the payment process, meaning like let's say it looks kind of dodgy of how the card is being processed. If you're at a restaurant where they take the card and they disappear for 20 minutes or so. Or if you think that the product there might be a question about whether the product will be satisfactory that you're purchasing. A lot of times people can, once they get the product, if they pay for it by credit card, if they're not happy with it, they can contact the company and ask for some kind of repair of the problem and the situation. If they don't get a satisfactory resolution, they can call the credit card company and say, hey, don't pay these people because I'm still not happy with it, and it gives you some leverage with the seller. Debit cards are better to use if you don't trust yourself, meaning that you'll use that ease and convenience of plastic to liquidate your own account for it. There is some new technology coming in the form of chips that are identifiable only for a single purchase. The credit card companies probably won't have those out at least until 2015. They're more common worldwide, but there's been a lot of headwinds in trying to get those installed and put into place, sometimes by the credit card company themselves. So in the meantime, one of the best ways to prevent this kind of fraud from happening to you is, first of all, check your debit card statements and your credit card statements, not just when you get them, but every single week, to make sure that there are no charges on there that aren't yours. And if they aren't yours, make sure you report them right away. And second of all, one of the best ways to avoid credit and debit card fraud is to pay cash.
Interesting points to think about. Well, we have lots of callers on the line waiting to talk to you, Kevin. Let's go to Lucy in Jefferson. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Lucy.
I have a question. Do you have a form or a place to find a form that you would suggest to track the monthly expenses, something online?
Sure. It depends on you know, what your apprehensions and goals are, but Mint.com is one of the better ones out there in terms of tracking expenses. And the reason I say about apprehension for it is there are two different kinds of expense trackers. One where you pay a little bit of money to use it, therefore, your information is hopefully protected from advertisers. And then there are ones like Mint, where in theory it's free, but sometimes your information can be exposed to other advertisers. And even the terms of agreement, they tell you that they have the right to, you know, share some of your information with people who might be interested. And some people are perfectly fine with that. And a lot of people listen to commercial radio stations or watch commercial television stations, and they look at ads to watch the programs in theory for free. Other people say, especially when it comes to financial data, that they're not really crazy about that. The other one is one called You Need a Budget, and I think that's YNAB.org, but I'll check and make sure and put the link up at OnYourMoney.com later on today.
Thanks for that call, Lucy. Don in Madison, what's your question?
Hi. Good morning. I got a question about a home equity line of credit. My wife and I have sufficient funds for 4 or 5 years of living, and we have no debt. Yet this proposal came from National Bank, home equity line of credit. We don't owe money on our house, but I presume that our house would be a component of this offer. Do you think I should do it? Go ahead and get a home equity line of credit from this outfit.
Have they given you any indication, Don, as to what the fees might be to either establish the home equity line of credit or keep it open?
They say payments as low as $203 and estimated APR of close to 5%.
Okay. If it's truly a home equity line of credit, you don't actually have to borrow the money. The home equity line of credit just gives you the option to borrow it, and if that's the, that's a fairly competitive interest rate. The fees are generally a few hundred dollars to set up the home equity line of credit. There might be an appraisal involved if you don't have a current one that that the lender can use. And there might be some other fees on there. And sometimes it can run between $600 to $800 just to get the home equity line of credit set up. Then if in the future you choose to tap that home equity line of credit, you can usually do so without any further approval from the lender. And you can do it for how much ever you need to get out of it up to the limit established. And so they might say to you, right, Don, you and your wife now have a $25,000 home equity line of credit, meaning tomorrow you can write a check for $25,000, and we're only going to charge you interest on that money that has to be paid back every single month. Eventually, the lender will say to you, okay, either pay it up or let's convert this to a fixed rate home equity loan for the remaining balance and with a fixed rate term. And it's actually safer to have a home equity line of credit than it is to not have one, because it sounds like you're in pretty good shape financially, but there might be a point in the future where you need access to the equity you've established in your home, and you don't want to sell any assets and you don't want to sell the home. By definition, in that situation, Don, the need for money makes it difficult to borrow against the home at that time. And so if you're willing to pay the fees and you're aware of the fees, it's actually a nice little insurance policy, and it's better to have it and not need it rather than need it and not have it. On the other hand, if you don't want to pay the fees, and sometimes people can't, for whatever reason, qualify for a home equity line of credit, then I think you sound like your cash should be enough to last in most emergencies.
Thanks for your call, Don. We're going to talk next to Kent in Greenville. Hi, Kent.
Oh, hi. I have sincere praise for Kevin, not fault. I'm wondering about reverse mortgages. I've heard they're kind of a tool of Wall Street. I just wonder if things have changed and it's more consumer-friendly.
From a long time ago, yes, and it is more consumer friendly. But recently, the rules have become a little bit more burdensome and a little more restrictive. What happened was, is 25 years, or probably 30 years ago, these reverse mortgages came out. What it allows people to do is borrow against their house without technically a credit application and still remain in their house. And the balance keeps growing and growing and growing, but does not need to be paid back until the borrower leaves the home or passes away, in which case they hopefully would leave the home as well. At that time, the home is sold, and the balance is of the money owed is paid off from the sales proceeds. If there's more in the sales proceeds than what is owed, the homeowner or the homeowner's estate or heirs get the difference. But if there's less, meaning there's a deficit between the two, they still don't owe any money. And technically, there's a program that subsidizes the bank for it. It's really, of course, the taxpayers who end up making the difference for it. But it can be a good idea for older people. It has to be for people who are over 62 and who are house rich and cash poor, meaning that they don't have a lot of liquid assets to live off of, but they want to stay and they're able to stay in their house. They have made it more difficult for people to get the reverse mortgages after the economic crunch, crisis, recession, whatever you want to call it, over the last 5 or 6 years. A lot of people took these out, and they weren't able to maintain their homes, and the homes didn't keep the value. And so to preserve the program, they've made it more restrictive, so it is harder to get in right now. I don't think it should be a first resort for people in retirement, but as a last resort, it can be a great way to allow an older person to stay in their home without having to try to come up with a, go out and get a part-time job or something.
Thanks for that question, Kent. And we have time for Wade in Galesville. Hi, Wade.
Hello. Good morning. Anecdotally, I'm one of those people who shopped at Target, and last weekend my credit card was stopped. They seem to have caught it in time, and they had been watching that there were no charges showing up, but all of a sudden something did happen.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that they stopped that. The other issues have been on top of this, because obviously they're going to be liable for the fraud. So there's a lot of preemptive card cancellations going on. It's one thing to check on it. Anytime you plan on using your credit card for a bigger expense in the future, whether it's shopping or traveling or something, call the company first and say, I just want to make sure before I use this, is everything okay? So I'm glad to hear you weren't hurt or inconvenienced by it so far.
Yeah, I appreciate their watchfulness. But I'm calling about something else. I'm 67 years old. I've got some Social Security, a small pension, and I'm working part-time because I enjoy it. But I do have some investments, too, and I'm trying to figure out how I want to start taking some of those investments. And the first question I have is, there's an annuity that somebody advised me I should go to the annuity first, because if I get a lifetime annuity, and I think it's a lifetime, could be set up that way, that I might have a chance to get into the insurance company's pockets, is how they said it. You know, I live long enough. And so that would be a wise place to start. I'm wondering what you think of that.
Is it just a tax-sheltered annuity? It's not kind of a retirement account or anything like that?
It's an insurance company annuity that was, yeah, it's, I don't think it's a, no, it's, well, it's tax-sheltered. I think I'm not paying taxes on it. It pays, sure, 3% a year.
Okay. I would actually tell you not to tap that, and especially if you have other assets from which you can draw to support yourself. Here's why. First of all, you're going to pay taxes on the money you pull out of that, and that'll be piled on top of your earnings, what other income, the Social Security payments that you might have as well. And so you might find yourself in a higher tax bracket if you pull the money out today rather than waiting. The second thing is that 3% is a very healthy and competitive interest rate right now. Sadly, it's not as safe as some people might lead you to believe, but 3% from an annuity is still a pretty good interest rate based on the predictability and reliability of the insurance company paying it off. And the final reason I would have you not do an immediate annuity is because interest rates are so low right now, Wade, you will be very disappointed when the annuity company would give you the money, the figures that they would base that immediate annuity on. What they'll do is they'll say, okay, how long do you want this money for? And you might say 10 years guaranteed, or my life, or people can choose to have it based on their own and their spouse's lives, whatever. You'll find that the figures you get back are almost going to be very close to if you just took that money and buried it in the hole in the ground and pulled it right out. And that's because the insurance company needs to invest these proceeds very safely to make sure that they can still pay you back in future years. And conservative investments right now pay very little in interest. And once you put the insurance company's operating expenses on top of that very little interest, there's really no money left over for it. So median annuities might be a good idea at some point down the road, but today it's not the time to do it. I'd rather have you just pull the money out as you need it and hopefully delay it as long as you can so that you're not earning money and it's not taxed at a higher rate than it otherwise would be if you were to wait.
Kevin, Michelle in Madison called in wanting your advice on starting an LLC. Should she file the paperwork herself or get an accountant's help?
She can do it herself by going to the state, the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. That's generally where people in Wisconsin file for an LLC. I think it's something that she can do the form herself. My preference would be she consult with a CPA, because if she's doing this for some kind of business, she's probably going to need help from a qualified tax person in the future, and they can give Michelle information not just on setting up the LLC, but also on why she might want to do that and why she may choose some other form of ownership. And then finally, all the tax ramifications, the ramifications of owning your own business, both good and bad, they can help her make sure she gets off on the right foot. So she can do it herself. My preference is she still goes to a CPA and maybe even a lawyer to get some advice on it beforehand.
Well, it's time for the website of the week. What is it this week, Kevin?
Well, I wanted to give a little special gift out to those of you who are thinking that winter will never end. And great living in the state of Wisconsin, where I figured it out. In 1 year, we have technically had a 130-degree swing almost between highs and lows, which, why we live here, I'm starting to question that right now. But if you are getting very bugged by the winter and getting some cabin fever, go to sproutrobot.com. Sproutrobot.com has both a free and a paid service. The free service allows you to put in your zip code, and it will tell you an entire planting schedule for all different kinds of garden and flowers, and it'll even send you an email to let you know when it's time to plant those various items. sproutrobot.com, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Four more words before we go?
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Thanks to Bill Martins, Christy Taylor, and Robin Cherry for producing. I'm Cynthia Schuster, and for Joy Cardine, this is the Ideas Network.